Well, that's Joe Cocker with Respect Yourself, and we've got some great news. A little bit of respect shown to take it from us. We are a finalist in the New Zealand Radio Awards. That's for last year, 2018, and we will discover at a ritzy function coming up in the middle of the year, I think it's Sky City, as to whether we win the particular category that we entered, and that is the best programs, best access radio spoken informational program. We actually played this entry to our listeners about 3 weeks ago. It involves a client of Mind and Body, Simon Frost, and we headed up our entry as Simon Frost, Hard Man and Kickboxer discloses emotional crisis. So great news for Take It From Us, a finalist in the New Zealand Radio Awards under Best Programs, Best Access Radio Spoken Informational Program.
Do we get to attend that and find out who wins there, or do we find out beforehand and then scurry along with our
little... No, I think we have to go along to the big ritzy function the Mike Hoskins and Guyan Espiners and people like that.
And John Campbell. I thought we were... last time we didn't, did we?
No, I don't think we attended last time. That was in 2013 when we were a finalist in that similar category.
It shows you modern technology. I'm going to butt out now.
Anyway, I'm host Sheldon Brown of Mental Health Radio. Take It From Us. And we've got producer Declan Caron. And I want to put in a special thanks to Declan for the really hard work he puts in terms of the technical side of Take It From Us, the production. He's a volunteer and he volunteers his time with great commitment, selects the music, and also makes a huge contribution in terms of his own lived experience. So
thank you,
Declan.
No worries.
Now, when you notice your mental health declining, do one small thing that brings you peace. Take a shower, text a loved one, step outside. One little step is all you need to remind yourself that this is not permanent. And one of the things that we need to safeguard against, and this is mentioned in the latest email from the Mind Tribe, and we interviewed Danny Kittner, who is the co-founder of the Mind Tribe. I'd really recommend and suggest that you get in touch with the Mind Tribe online and sign up for their weekly email. And their weekly email this week says, isolation kills. It kills ideas, confidence, and stunts our creative growth. Creativity is an inevitable part of the human condition. Creating is not just about arts and crafts, but encompasses everything from the way we shape our perspective in the morning to what we cook for dinner at night. Think of a time when you created something, whether working with others or drawing on knowledge gained from others. You were not creating in isolation. Isolation is not just physical. What we think and feel can isolate us from creating a meaningful connection with our environment. We believe some of our most difficult days happen when we are unable to create or connect. So for the week ahead, the Mind Tribe is suggesting be mindful of your creative self and what might be isolating you from building a meaningful connection with your environment. If you are feeling isolated, call someone, go for a walk, or cook your favourite meal. Does that ring a bell with you, Declan?
My favourite meals are easy. I usually just buy the meal for one, fire it in the microwave, go and watch TV and come back when it pings.
Well, I've discovered sachets of pasta, and I cooked one of these on Sunday night after going to Countdown, and I put some olives and small tomatoes and some mint out of the garden and fancied it up a little bit. And
yeah, those ones that come out looking like permed hair in one great big clump, they're quite nice, actually.
Oh, that's a different type of pasta, isn't it?
No, that's not a pasta. What is it? It's a whole lot of worms all congregated together. Well, I don't know what they call it. Stir-fry or something.
A stir-fry, yeah. Well, today on Take It From Us, we bring you a broadcast from Mad in America. Mad in America website, it features a series of podcasts produced by Mad in America, and Take It From Us has gained approval from Mad in America to use these podcasts on occasion. Mad in America's mission is to serve as a catalyst for rethinking psychiatric care. It believes that the current drug-based care has failed society and that scientific research, as well as the lived experience of those who have been diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder, calls for profound change. Our program features a Mad in America broadcast with psychotherapist Alita Taylor. Now, Alita is a licensed marriage and family therapist and trainer. She's from Washington in the United States. Alita is an ambassador for a technique called open dialogue. And in the early parts of this interview, you'll hear some endorsements about open dialogue from clients who have experienced it. Her pursuit of this open dialogue technique fulfills her passion in mental health to work from a community-based, non-expert, open dialogue perspective. And this open dialogue utilizes social networks, family, and facilitation with other professionals. Well, here's the Mad in America broadcast, which is around about 30 minutes long.
Welcome to the Mad in America podcast, your source for science, psychiatry, and social justice. Hello, this is James, and welcome to episode 58 of the Mad in America podcast. And this week, we turn our attention to open dialogue, and we chat with psychotherapist and open dialogue trainer Alita Taylor. But before we do that, I wanted to share some audio that relates the experiences of people who underwent open dialogue training in the UK. And this audio is kindly provided by Open Dialogue UK and Nick Putman.
And it's been emotional. Very emotional at times, but so valuable, such a valuable and unique experience. It's made me look at my whole practice of how I reflect, how I interact with people.
I've really enjoyed it. I've loved meeting all the other people who were on it. I have great respect for the trainers. I've mentioned not long ago that I was very impressed by their capacity to allow things to happen and arise of their own accord and not to direct. And there have been times when there's been quite a lot of uncertainty, I think, in the room, and they've sat with it. And out of that has come something fresh and helpful.
In terms of the educational process, I have a mixture. You know, I have dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, a degree of autism. All of these have been diagnosed in the last 8 years. And so I've struggled through the educational process without knowing these things. It was only when I was on the CBT for psychosis course that these things came to the fore and I had to go and see an educational psychologist. One of the big reliefs, the biggest relief for me, the apart from that self-knowledge, is that I've just been able to be open about it. And that, to me, is inherently part of the dialogical process. It's not that anything big has been made of it, but just having being able to say that, asking people to repeat things because I couldn't take in the information, and this being done without any sense that it was a big deal, has been really, really important for me.
So now on to our interview, and this week we welcome Alita Taylor. Alita is a licensed marriage and family therapist, an open dialogue trainer and facilitator based in Tacoma, Washington, USA. Alita has been working in mental health care in various roles since 1992. Her passion is working from a community-based, non-expert, need-adapted open dialogue perspective, which utilizes social networks, family, and co-facilitation with other professionals. And in this interview, we talk about what led Alita to her interest in open dialogue, and particularly her interest in training and facilitation. Alita, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat today for the Mad in America podcast. And to kind of get us started to begin with, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe how you came to be working in the mental health field.
Thank you, James. It's nice to be here. So I have been a counselor since high school, really, and I remember getting a call from somebody at my church one afternoon who was in, I could tell something was wrong on the phone, silence, and it turns out he was suicidal with a gun, and, you know, I sat and talked with him on the phone for quite a while, and he was an acquaintance of mine, and we agreed to get together, and after that, and I remember the feeling afterwards. I mean, he took the bullets out of the gun and got help and everything eventually. But I remember the feeling of the space in between me and him over the phone was quite timeless. And I remember feeling quite honored that he called me. Mm. And I remember feeling like I didn't know what to do. And thinking about what might help him. And I really didn't know. And so one thing led to another, me majoring in psychology and then eventually working in an emergency room, getting my license as a family therapist, and also watching One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with my dad, seeing the way the hospitals were way back when was a little alarming to me, but also very interesting to me. And I just really enjoyed sitting with that unknown space of the, and also the unusual behaviors that that people have when they're in crisis, or even in, you know, in schizophrenia, you know, or what's called that. I've always enjoyed, you know, listening to the thoughts of others when they're not making a lot of sense. Sometimes sometimes they do in some strange way. So that's a little bit about how it found me.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, obviously, Alita, you know, you've already described there that you've had a range of different experiences within mental health. And I know that you kind of now work or have worked for a while as a psychotherapist and have a particular interest in open dialogue and in training in open dialogue. So I just wondered if there was anything in particular in your kind of mental health experience that led you towards the open dialogue route.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it until 2016 when I went to the R.D. Lang Symposium at Esalen. And what led me there was I was attending a lot of retreats, trying to avoid burnout, really. I was working in an emergency room for over 10 years doing psychiatric assessments and dispositions and admissions. And I was seeing a lot of people that were in crisis that weren't really getting help. It was frustrating to me not being able to continue seeing people or at least get them to somebody who was going to see them consistently. It was frustrating working in a system that couldn't get everybody on the same page, essentially. And so I learned about Open Dialogue. It was only just about an hour talk that Nick Putman gave and was invited there to speak about. And the work made so much sense to me that I immediately applied to get into the trainer's training that was upcoming that year. And now that I have learned it, I have an even deeper passion to make sure people learn about it who are mental health workers, because I have found a huge relief in being able to work this way. And it's very, makes so much sense that it's very hard to work another way now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if it's okay, I'd like to ask specifically about Open Dialogue. So and I wondered if you could kind of help me understand how Open Dialogue works and perhaps how it's different to what we might consider more standard or more mainstream therapies or interventions.
Yeah, well, it almost in some ways it feels more mainstream than anything else, because it allows for more possibilities. And how it works is actually in the development of Open Dialogue, it wasn't even called that. It was named that, you know, years later after it was discovered that the rates of schizophrenia in this area of Western Lapland, catchment area of the areas around Rovaniemi, Tornio, Kemi, they were doing things differently in order to reduce the number of cases and hospitalizations. Hospitals were overflowing at the time, and they were charged with trying to figure out, you know, how to treat mental health crisis differently. So they started to work together, go into people's homes. They say themselves they made mistakes working, trying to figure this out, but they discovered that when they worked together, it was much better. They had a psychologist, Jaakko Seikkula from the University of Jyväskylä, was doing a lot of research in how they were training and how they were learning to work differently. And Tom Anderson from Norway, they brought in people to figure out, you know, what to do differently. And the name Open Dialogue actually didn't even come until until several years later, when they looked back and looked at, you know, what it was that they were doing. And they, and the seven principles were developed or during that time, not really knowing that they were enacting these principles. And what those principles are very simply immediate help, which means that they always answered the phone, they and always arranged for help for people quickly, within, you know, 24 hours. They didn't have them call somewhere else. They, you know, would send a team of people. Another principle is working with families and social networks. In other words, when someone called for help, they would always have the people in that person's life at the treatment, and they'd call those network meetings. Another thing they would do is they would work flexibly and mobily, meaning that they would make it centered around what the person was asking for help in terms of what they needed. So they didn't prescribe 6 weeks of twice a week, or you have to be in the hospital tonight, or, you know, we need to have somebody stay in your home, or we need to come back next week. They would always end every treatment with, you know, well, what, where should we go from here? What should we do next? Which is a beautiful way of working, because what I discovered about working with people in crisis is that they're in a timeless space, and they don't, we don't know what they're going to be like in 3 hours or in 2 days. And so maybe they need to have some help with sleep or with something more immediate, but we don't know that, you know, they're necessarily going to need a 5 to 7 day hospitalization just because they're having a crisis in this hour or on this day. And you know, they all share responsibility. That's another way that open dialogue works, and they welcome all the voices, and they tolerate uncertainty, and they follow up. That's what the work essentially is.
Thank you, Elisa. I really like that description of it. And in kind of reading around this, I guess what really appealed to me about this was you write how open dialogue is about listening and allowing space and being careful not to add your own words or definitions or perhaps diagnoses or whatever else into the equation. And that strikes me as quite different from perhaps therapy that I've had or other people have had, where you can only play a part in the therapy if you agree to abide by the kind of definitions and diagnoses and words and language that the therapist uses. But this strikes me as quite different.
Yes. Yeah, it is. And it's based a lot on dialogism, basically. The Russian philosopher Bakhtin, a lot of his work around how we come to meaning and how the definition of the self is made in social ways and between the space between oneself and others. That's the principle that about polyphony present in the way that open dialogue is practiced, is that the more voices, you know, that we bring in, the more possibilities there are to create meaning and to make meaning. And when we make definitions or diagnoses or symptoms out of someone else's experience, we're limiting their experience. As soon as we name it, we are making an identity for them rather than creating space where, you know, what they are going through and what they're experiencing and what they're trying to make meaning out of, it actually gets abbreviated. It gets taken away from them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I say, it's quite refreshing to hear of an approach where actually the person involved has an equal standing with the therapist and with the other people that are part of the process. And I think that's that certainly appeals to me.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the work. In fact, it's very useful too to a lot of open dialogue work is expanding to include peer professionals in the treatment team, which is very useful because there's someone there that's been through something quite similar and can relate to the, you know, not being understood or being in crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And Alita, in terms of how open dialogue is kind of being used around the world, I know myself that currently here in the UK, we've actually got a randomized controlled trial of open dialogue therapy on the NHS being led by some kind of progressive psychiatrists over here. But I just wondered, you know, is open dialogue widely used around the world, or is it still gaining traction, or, you know, how is it being utilized in areas outside of Finland?
Well, it's gaining interest, and it has the most wide amount of research of anything on early psychosis that's ever been done, and I'm surprised that it's not being practiced more, and perhaps in places people are doing it and they don't know that they're doing it, and they're, because it's sort of intuitive. And I think, you know, a lot of people that go into mental health want to be helpers and want to do good. And I remember being in the hallways of the ER, you know, between curtains or what have you, with people experiencing perhaps what might be an early psychosis or what have you, their family there, confused, wanting to get them help. But oftentimes, I would be creating what I saw to be maybe a network meeting right there in the emergency room with nurses and counselors and crisis workers and family kind of coming in and out on the edges of what was going on. And I think we need to do more of that. And maybe it might not be part of a randomized trial or what have you, but I think we need to just question more and more what is happening in the moment, and challenge the tick boxes that we have lined up in those risk assessments and, you know, symptomology lists and things like that. When something looks like early psychosis, I think the last thing we need to do is start saying, oh, you know, this is an early schizophrenia and we're going to put them on a injectable and everything's going to be okay. I mean, that's just not, that's not at all what they did, you know, in Western Lapland that has these incredible results. You know, they more and more worked from a space of not knowing what's happening and just listening more and asking for more helpers and keeping the team that was with that person consistent, you know, over time. So what I'm hoping to do is that the research that is already going on in all over the world on early psychosis can start to adopt the principles of open dialogue within the work they're doing. For instance, the Navigate program through Stanford on early psychosis using CBT. I'm a part of that network, and they're asking questions all the time and creating meetings, and they're saying, what is it with this meaning making work that, you know, like, does anybody else find that they're, you know, having their, you know, patients try to make meaning out of what's happening? And so it takes a critical mass, I think, eventually of changing the infrastructure so that, you know, we don't need to put psychosis and mental health issues into a bucket, just like, you know, having a bacterial infection or diabetes or something that's very concrete in course. I think the psychiatrists, not only them, but especially them, I feel have a great opportunity to start rediscovering why they wanted to go into this in the first place, because as they're discovering that the medicines that have been developed for thought disorders, we really never thought that they would work in the first place that well for delusions and hallucinations anyway. Mm. And they're in the long term quite, you know, dangerous. Open dialogue is neutral on, you know, the use of medications. They don't, you know, not anti-medication, but I think a lot of psychiatrists feel, you know, like they would, if once they know about this and once they can share the work with other practitioners and be in the room with a family therapist trained to run a network meeting and with a peer professional, that they might enjoy being in the role of not having to have the answers all the time.
So, Alita, could you tell me a little bit about outcomes of open dialogue and, you know, what studies show about outcomes?
Yeah, there are amazing studies that have been done over the last couple of decades, especially there's one out in December in Psychiatry Research that looks at 19-year long-term outcomes for people that experienced open dialogue, and statistically significant rates of lower unemployment, lower disability allowances, lower mental health service usage, lower neuroleptic use were all outcomes of this study, so that people were back to school or back to work and didn't need mental health treatment who did receive open dialogue even after 1 or 2 years of receiving treatment, and less hospitalizations too. So I think the numbers are something like 70%, 70 to 85%, depending on which study you're looking at. So it's incredibly effective at saving dollars, and not only dollars, but saving our society for being able to be productive.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's you know, here in the UK, and I think the US is similar. You know, we what we seem to be doing with standard approaches is creating lifelong patients. So, you know, they enter the mental health system and then they never really leave it. You know, they're perhaps on drugs for many years or having some kind of brief therapy but spread over many years or in and out of hospitals. So, you know, I can see that there's a compelling case there that if outcomes are so good and people can move beyond the mental health system, then there's every reason to fund this, isn't there?
Yeah. Exactly.
And Alita, if we can move on to talk a little bit about training, because you're an open dialogue trainer. And I was perhaps interested to know broadly how open dialogue training would work, because it strikes me that because there don't seem to be fixed rules or a fixed definition around how approaches should be used, you know, in a particular way. I wondered if it was a challenge to train people in something that's not kind of rigidly applied, if you like.
Yeah, well, this was the best training that I've ever taken in my career, and I've taken a lot of trainings. And the reason why I think it was is because the training was actually given dialogically, right. Meaning that, yeah, we came to learn things through one another, and we were supervised. We did work outside of the training with, you know, running a network meeting and videotaping it and watching ourselves and bringing it back. We did exercises on what our own inner dialogue was, and we had to watch a 7-minute portion of a session of ourselves and write down every thought we had while we were sitting there. And so mostly the training for me was unlearning, or rather allowing to fade to the background a lot of the answers that I have been trained to look for and the patterns that I had been trained to see and to put into a diagnostic framework. That's all still in the background, but the training was so enjoyable because I was able to learn to listen probably deeper than I even knew that I could, and allow lots of space to allow the family and the client to talk to one another, because they are the real experts on their life, and it's quite rewarding, you know, the couple of families that we're able to see with our team, just to be a human being in the room with them. You know, I'm a professional and I'm a human being. So a lot of the work of training is, it's never ending, but there's a thing called reflections that takes place in the network meeting that the word came from Tom Anderson in Norway observing perhaps families through a one-way mirror. He would say, you know, be talking to his colleagues about what he saw through the one-way mirror, and he'd say, well, what would happen if we took this away and we were in the room the whole time so that we didn't talk behind this one-way mirror about the family, but we shared what we were thinking and what occurred to us in the moment right there and then, you know, what would that be like? And so there's a really beautiful way in practicing open dialogue where, you know, there's a rule, nothing about you without you, basically is kind of the way they work in Western Lapland, because they don't go in another room, a treatment plan meeting or whatever, that's what it's called in hospitals here, when the whole treatment team gets together for 2 hours in the morning and talks about everybody in the hospital that's there without them there, without the family there. It's sort of ludicrous when you think about it, but it's a beautiful thing to, you know, witness a family and then be able to witness your own experience and then decide, you know, should I share this? And, you know, what would be the point of sharing this? And maybe I don't know, but it's one of my favorite ways of working because it really honors the process and brings us back into the present moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, you know, that's really nicely described. And Alita, I understand that you have training yourself starting in April this year. So for people listening who were interested to know more about open dialogue training, where could they go to find out perhaps more about you and more about the upcoming training?
Yeah, we're really excited. The Open Dialogue UK is helping Open Dialogue Washington start a training. So Nick Putman and I and others from Finland, if it reaches the capacity, we can bring more trainers from Finland also. It's opendialoguewashington.com is the website, and they can go there to sign up. There's still space. It's in Washington, Tacoma, Washington, which is near Seattle. And it's a year-long training to learn how to do the work to facilitate a network meeting. And it's for professionals, for peers, for advocates, psychiatrists, family therapists, social workers, counselors. There's even psychiatric occupational therapists taking the training, nutritionists that work in hospitals taking the training. And it starts in April. It's Wednesday through Sunday, all day, and there's four blocks. We go till early 2020.
Great, thank you. And so I just wondered if there was anything else that you wanted to share.
Yeah, I'd like to thank the healing field in Tacoma. Christine and Poe Karchewski have done a lot to support Open Dialogue here. They really wanted it back with their own son, who was going through a crisis several years ago. They found Open Dialogue, and when they learned that I moved here, were ecstatic that they're both psychiatric nurse practitioners that are really working hard to get state funding for the training and to get the word out that this kind of way of working is here. I'd like to also thank our clients that we have been working with, sometimes in their home and sometimes they drive from pretty far away to come and see us and my team. Fletcher Taylor is a psychiatrist.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm Declan. It usually comes back to say I'm Sheldon Brown with Declan on the panel. But, did you want to say anything before I...
Well, we've just come out of that, the last few minutes of that interview where Alita Taylor was thanking so many of the people that have been involved in this open dialogue. You can access that interview with Alita Taylor on planetaudio.org.nz/takeitfromus immediately after our show finishes. So I'll just... pass you over to Declan, who's going to play a track, and then we'll have some other features on our award-winning...
I'll give you a prize if you can guess what the song is. No. This one I've got for you anyway. It's got quite a good music video. It was filmed in an English country house, and the owner appeared as an extra. It was filmed in Reading. Is it Berkshire?
Reading.
That's it.
Yep.
Yeah. And, I'm not very good with that sort of stuff. This guy was seeing somebody. Well, he was sort of seeing them. It wasn't a major relationship, but he generally felt something for this person, and he kept getting the impression that she didn't like him as much as he liked her. So, it all went the wrong way, I think. They just stayed as friends. Anyway, here's Ollie Mears, and please don't let me go.
Where do I begin? Should I tell you how bad I need you now? Yeah, you're underneath my skin. I never knew what
Show me that you're caring. You see my fascination. Tell me I'm not mistaken. Give me the information I need.
With Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And news today for Take It From Us is that we are a finalist in the New Zealand Radio Awards in the category of Best Access Radio Spoken Informational Program. We're up against Arrow FM and Plains FM at Planet FM features there, and our program that we played about 3 or 4 weeks ago entitled Simon Frost, Hard Man and Kickboxer Discloses Emotional Crisis. So we'll know probably middle of the year how we've done on that, but we were a finalist in 2013 in the New Zealand Radio Awards, and of course have picked up 9 consecutive awards in the Planet FM annual awards, which were called the Mikeys. They have now been discontinued.
We've got to wait till the middle of the year to find out whether or not we've scored.
Well, we've scored anyway, Declan, but it'd be nice to be the absolute winner of that category.
We've only got 2 to elbow out, just as well we've got 2 elbows.
Right, exactly. And going back to the interview we played from Mad in America, the Mad in America podcast with Alita Taylor. Some quite catchy phrases there where the mental health system is accused of creating lifelong patients. I'm sure that is the case in New Zealand. The other one, which is very close to home, was nothing about you without you, and that's one of the catch cries of the people with lived experience, consumers, that nothing should be planned, nothing should be organised, treatment should not be administered without the patient. This open dialogue technique clearly involved family at treatment meetings. And last week we did an analysis of the annual report of the mental health, the Director of Mental Health and Addictions, Dr. John Crawshaw, and in covering off Maori mental health, he mentioned that they were only achieving a 60% rate of inclusion with family and whānau at treatment meetings, at meetings where diagnoses were being undertaken and where medication was being discussed. So only 6 out of every 10 families are involved in that in Maori mental health and our New Zealand mental health system. So some interesting points about open dialogue, and we hope that you might want to access that again on planetaudio.org.nz/ take it from us. Now, I've got an article here headed up, Rediscovering who you are after a severe depressive episode. This is by a Joy Harrod. It goes back a few years, but I think it's still very relevant. It says, there are some things in life that can leave a person imprisoned in their own mind. Depression is one of them. Since the beginning of this year, depression has had its gnarly grip on me and refused to let go. It got so bad I made a serious attempt on my life and soon after was sectioned and admitted to a psychiatric ward. I was a patient there for around 12 to 14 weeks, including a couple of weeks preparing for discharge leave. Although one day I will write about my admission, I want to focus now on what it's like to completely lose yourself to depression and how it feels trying to put everything back together again. I think the hardest part of this depressive episode has been when I've slightly come out of it and realised where I've been and what I've lost. Don't get me wrong, being at the bottom of the deepest, darkest pit wasn't a joyful walk in the park, but to me, giving up felt so much easier than fighting. Giving up wasn't an option, though. While I had given up on myself, others hadn't and were fighting to keep me alive until I could fight for myself. And that's the point I'm at now, back in the community and taking control of my life again. At least trying to, anyway. Returning home doesn't automatically mean everything is back to normal and I'm cured. In fact, I'm still very low and struggling with many aspects of daily living. Who knows, emptying the dishwasher could be so overwhelming. Don't even get me started on cooking or showering. But what I'm finding even harder than mundane tasks is rediscovering who I am. Depression stole my identity and my joy. Trying to find myself again while still feeling exhausted, low, and riddled with anxiety is one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. Everything I knew and enjoyed feels like a distant memory, and building myself back up feels like an impossible task. I can't remember what genuine happiness feels like. I've had glimpses of it, but the feeling doesn't stick around. I can't remember how to socialise. Even texting friends is difficult. I used to enjoy colouring, church, volunteering, reading, driving with tunes blasting and singing at the top of my voice, even in traffic, going out with friends, going for meals, long walks with the dogs, my partner, and seeing family. All these things are incredibly hard to do now. I either can't remember how to do them, get too anxious and overwhelmed to do them, or physically can't do them. But I am trying. Each day I get up, even when everything within me wants to stay under my duvet, I take my medication, engage with mental health professionals, and I make sure I eat three meals a day. I set myself 1 to 3 daily tasks, such as emptying the dishwasher, vacuuming, posting to my mental health mission Facebook page, reading my emails, sorting appointments, showering, sitting outside for 5 minutes, watching some TV. I don't always manage them, but I'm trying to be compassionate with myself and listen to loved ones when they say these things will take time and the only person who is pressuring me is me. Each day I'm trying to do little things I used to do with the hope that one day I'll rediscover joy. So to those who have been through this and have come out the other side, I admire you because it isn't easy, but you've shown me it's worth it. And for those of you who are trying to fight your way out of depression, like me, be kind to yourself. Take things a day at a time and remember, it isn't a race, it's a journey.
That's actually quite important there. I was just making a few notes while you were talking about that, if I can jump in here. And the pressure off yourself, I think, is the big thing, because one of the words I like to try and take out of my vocabulary is I should do this or I should do that, because it's like a guilt word. But remember I said in previous shows about the new normal? and it's finding where your new happy place is. Something that I don't know if I can throw in here or not, but I've got a friend at the moment going through some tough stuff coming out of dealing with his mum's death, and he's just come off a medication called, I think it's Seroquel. And he's having, he just sort of finds himself zoning out and having flashbacks. And it's only when someone at work sort of touches him on the shoulder that he comes to. So, yeah, and apparently it's increased since he's come off it. So I don't know what to do working around that. So if anyone's got any ideas, whether they can email you, or I'm going to do a bit of research on the internet, but it's really affecting me.
But
at the moment.
he's still able to work.
Yeah, he's still able to work, but he said he just zones out. He has flashbacks, and it's like he's there, but as workmates say, it's like you've gone somewhere else. He said, I have these flashbacks, and they've increased since he's come off the Seroquel, but he should have only been on the Seroquel for a short period of time.
Yeah, so, well, you did say that we can put pressure on ourselves, and the author of this little article, Joy Harrod, makes it clear that it isn't a race, it's a journey. But, of course, if we have a job, if we've taken time out, we might have been in hospital for a couple of weeks, often there is a pressure to get back to work. My own experience, the beginning of last year, where the radio show went off air for about 3 weeks. And, you know, I felt a responsibility. In fact, it certainly was one of the incentives to get out of hospital and get back into work. The radio show was a big incentive because of the responsibility of broadcasting.
Of course, I rocked up and gave you a bit of a kick at your chair. No, it was actually good. We had one of those real tasty ice creams too at the Domain, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. We did too when you came to visit me.
Yeah, but just what I was saying with those flashbacks is he was talking to me on the phone the other day because his, the psychiatrist guy that he's seeing is going off on a year's leave shortly. So he was saying the other day, he said, I just tend to zone out. He said, I just realised I'd, lucky the tram wasn't that close, but he's in Melbourne. He said, I realised I'd sort of like stepped out and a tram was coming, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So not good, and it's difficult when you're in another city to be other than on the end of a phone, which is...
And being supportive at a distance is often difficult. Well, let's take another music break, Declan, and we'll come back for our community notices.
Well, coming into winter, a song here which describes a woman who is materialistic and selfish, and the singer warns that her behaviour will come back to haunt her someday. It's a song by Foreigner, and it's called Cold as Ice. You're with 104.6 Planet FM and Mental Health Radio. Take it from us.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love. You never take. Away a fortune.
It From Us community notice board.
Now, Whareiki, which is an excellent adult mental health service in Papatoa, it's for Tangata Whaiora and Family Whānau services. It has its enrolment this week, started on the 29th of April, right through to the 3rd of May, between 10am and 2pm for their Term 2 2019 enrolment event. They've got a program overview for Term 2 and their opening hours are between 9 and 5 Monday to Friday. You can call Whareiki on 09279 8233 to find out what their program is for Term 2. Their unique services include one-on-one peer support or the opportunity to join a peer support group, support services for family and whānau, a three-day program offering a range of educational opportunity, information and support around self-advocacy or speaking out for ourselves. So if this sounds like you, they say, our staff would love to meet you. So they are at 54 Carruth Street in Old Papatoa and the phone number is 09279 8233. And next Monday, the 6th of May, at the Rimu Room, Windsor Park Baptist Church at 550 East Coast Road in Mairangi Bay, they've got a meeting of Our Voice Committee. This is a consumer initiative. It's run by Equip, so you can let Equip know on Our Voice at Equip. .net.nz if you'd like to attend that. It's 1:30 to 3:30 Monday the 6th of May at the Rimu Room, Windsor Park Baptist Church, and I have attended one of those and it was an excellent meeting. You can phone or text 027 227 0015 if you want to RSVP.
And if you forget your lunch, there's KFC at the front.
Well, I think they also provide lunch. So, yeah, that's it's something that's important as well. I was going to bring you some information about the five foods that could be contributing to anxious thoughts and low mood. I can just clip through those pretty quickly. Gluten is one. Dairy is the second. Sugar is the third. Alcohol, which it's not surprising is included there, is the fourth. And coffee is the fifth. So we're out of here, are we, Declan?
I think we pretty much are. Yeah.
Okay, well, this is from the finalist program in the New Zealand Radio Awards, taken from us in the best spoken and informational program under Access Radio.
And we'll catch you next week. I'm off for KFC. No, just kidding.